ABC Social History Unit presents Soldering On, the sixth program in the series Bright Sparks, Australian Radio Stories, compiled by Stephen Rapley.
I was sitting for my what was then known as the leaving certificate. I couldn't get my mind off radio. I studied all my other subjects purely as drudgery, but I was really sold on radio. That's all I could think about. And I managed to get through the exams and all that sort of thing, but straight after that, back to radio. I only wanted to play with radio. It was quite an obsession.
The 1930s was a boom period for the radio set makers in Australia. Radio was seen more and more as a cheaper source of entertainment and news, and not such a luxury or marvel. By the end of the 30s, two out of three homes would have a radio, and that's not counting the unlicensed listeners. According to radio historian Jack Ross, the turning point for the industry was around 1934.
There were a number of major technical developments which really changed things. Nearly all receivers up until about 1930 or a little bit thereafter were battery receivers, which made it extremely difficult for people to operate these things because of the high costs. And also the particular circuitry that was used at the time there, most of the circuits were what they called tuned radio frequency or Neutrodyne and a few others, and they were extremely difficult for the non-technical householder to operate. You needed to turn about three or four dials separately, and you'd spend half an hour trying to get a station. And even when you did, the damn thing would be howling and bursting into oscillation, and if you lived closer into the city there, every time it burst into oscillation, of course your neighbour suffered, and you'd hear him screaming out about that kid next door with his wireless or something like that. Anyhow, about that 34, the a new type of circuit, although it had been developed many, many years before by Edward Armstrong of FM fame, the Super Heterodyne, by 1934 the manufacturers had realised the potential of that circuit, and they pulled out all stops and developed it to a high level of efficiency. And come 1934, I think every manufacturer in Australia, and there were a lot of them, were marketing Super Heterodyne receivers. And, of course, that's the type of circuit that's still in use today. Now, that really brought about a change in things, because all you had to do was to turn one knob to tune in a station, and you could get any station you wanted to with just that one knob instead of two or three. Also, the numbers of receivers tended to increase rapidly. I think they're getting over the depression. People had a few more pounds around to spend on these things. And because the manufacturers were producing more and more receivers, the prices were tending to fall. They were also producing small units, midgets or table models there, that allowed these things to be in the kitchen where the lady of the house could hear the programs too, which meant that she could, in fact, listen to programs like the serials and that there that she wouldn't have done had she had to stop work and go into the lounge room.
The local radio industry was protected by a tariff barrier set up in 1930. This limited the import of cheaper sets and components from America, Britain and Europe. As well as the giants like AWA, many small factories, often employing only a dozen workers, sprang up all over the country. Receivers were built in backyards and tiny workshops in every town, and many young enthusiasts began their radio careers on the factory assembly line. Neville Williams, for a long-time editor of the magazine Radio and Hobbies, started out at the factory of Reliance Radio in York Street, Sydney.
A very old three-storey building with a basement, and like most of the buildings of that age in that area, it was rat-infested. They did their best to clean it up and keep it clean and so on, but it was a very old building. I was one of two, actually. They put on another wire very shortly afterwards, who was just as crazy about radio as I was. We were both required to work for £1 a week, which was about $2 a week. But we both thought that we were in heaven, because here we were mad on radio, and here was Messrs. Craven and Wild willing to pay us money to work at it. And we were so mad on it that we'd start at 8 o'clock in the morning, I think it was. We'd come to lunchtime at 12 or thereabouts. We'd have our lunch, and then we'd have half an hour to spare. So why waste it? So we'd get back to the bench and keep on doing what we wanted to do, and through till 5 o'clock, whenever it was at night.
Arthur Spring started his career at Crown Radio's factory.
It was a deadly sort of a place, really. It was dark, and oh, it was so damn dark. And we had this little hole at the back, little room. It was not much bigger than a bush dunny, really. And there was only one skylight up at the top. And, of course, aeroplanes in those days weren't all that frequent. One came low over there one day. Lugubrious Arthur Spring wanted to have a look at it. He leaned forward to look out through the skylight, trod on his soldering iron cord, and you know what happens. It goes on the floor. And you know what happens next, of course, when you reach down in the dark to pick it up. You pick it up by the wrong end. It slipped out of my hand. I couldn't understand that until I felt the sting. Yeah, anyhow, that's how dark it was.
A factory was big and roomy and airy. I think there wasn't much of a problem with ventilation. Holidays were non-existent. You just took it for granted that you worked right through the year, that you didn't have such a thing as annual leave. That wasn't known in the workforce. And I think if anybody wanted to take a holiday, you'd have had to beg time off without pay. We just didn't have holidays.
Elizabeth Wallace worked in a more spacious factory in Adelaide at the National Radio Corporation. She was the first woman in South Australia to become a radio amateur, and when she joined National, she worked as a tester.
Conditions of work were regarded as quite reasonable, quite comfortable, although we didn't have holidays. The hours of work were not considered excessive, or at least I didn't find it so, because I'd been working in shop work and shops working longer hours than the factory. But we did have to work on Saturday mornings. You had to go in on Saturday mornings, I think for 3 or 4 hours. You worked half a day on Saturdays, and it was very great advance, I think, in industries generally, when the five-day week was introduced.
There's no such thing as fans or air conditioners or anything like that. You were more or less on an assembly line, and a lot of the assembly lines, you had a certain amount of the set to do, and then when you finished that, it went on to the next fella. But they were arranged in timed intervals, so that when the time was up, you had to be ready to pass it to the next one, and that's how they done it.
During the 30s, George Mann worked at a number of radio factories, like Reliance, STC, Britain, Tasma, and Airzone.
When I worked at Airzone, we had three-minute intervals. The set had to be passed every 3 minutes to the next one, but you didn't have a terrible lot of work to do. Of course, you couldn't do a lot in 3 minutes, but it was all arranged so that you'd have one operator, it'd be poking the wires in the sockets and twisting them around, and the next operator, all he'd have was a soldering iron. And he'd just go bang, 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 and solder all the joints, you see. And then up to the end of the line, at Airzone, I was working on the end of the line, and it was my job to wire up one socket, I think, audio socket or something like that, and then just clasp my eyes all quickly all through the set to see if there was any joints that weren't missed, and then pass it on to the test rooms for testing.
In 3 minutes?
Three-minute operation. The unfortunate part about it was if you found you had to go to the toilet, well, then you were in a bit of bother, because the assembly line had to keep running. If you went to the toilet, you'd find that when you come back, what sets you should have done while you're at the toilet would be put underneath your bench, and then you would stay back after work and clear the line. Of course, you got nothing for that. That was your fault, because you shouldn't have gone to the toilet in the boss's time. You should have gone in your own time. And that was the general rule with a lot of them. You couldn't stop the assembly line from running.
We're talking about a radio industry that was comparable with the rag trade for hire and fire and general practices. That's just about how it stood.
What do you mean by hire and fire? Were there seasons, high seasons and low seasons?
Oh, it was worse than that. I mean, if we didn't have an order from Bebber Falls for unbranded radios next week, you were fired. It was as short as that. You were virtually on a one-week basis. Yeah, it was all very short order.
The factories, in particular the smaller factories tended to use the services of juniors, and the wages were quite low, and the tendency was that as soon as a person reached 21 and required senior wages, they were dismissed. That was quite common.
Keith Sherlock started his radio work in AWA's factory, where they made loudspeakers.
Conditions weren't all that terribly bad. The factories were fairly comfortable, and although fairly primitive, I suppose, by modern standards, but we survived.
Could you sit when you were doing the work, or did you have to stand?
No, we could mainly sit. On some jobs, of course, it wasn't possible to sit, so you had to stand all day, which became pretty tiring.
How did you cope with the monotony of it, of that wiring, say? When you've got to actually concentrate and do it correctly.
Yes, well, you had to do that. And I suppose it was, you could sort of put your mind in neutral and go through the motions and think of your hobbies and maybe your friends, your girlfriends and so on. But it was a pretty boring existence. Any sort of mass production was. In some of the slack times, I actually worked for the Ford Motor Company, and they, of course, had a production line. And you had to keep up with that production line or else. And, you didn't have much time to dash around and talk to your mates. It was just a case of keeping up as best you could. Otherwise you'd find that there'd be someone else there in your place the next day. That was the sort of thing you had to put up with. There's always someone at the door waiting to take your job if you were negligent in any way.
I can remember quite well at Airzone, you always found three or four fellows sitting out the front of the factory. And the idea was if anybody that was on the assembly lines wasn't up to standard and he got the bullet, well, there was always another fellow sitting out the front ready to take his place. And this was something that went on in those days, but you'd never believe that, but that was actual fact. Yeah.
It wasn't a permanent occupation. It was very seasonal work during the winter time, and in the slack period of the summer, we either had to go for an enforced holiday or find another factory around the place where there was a little work available.
See, what happened with the factories is over the Christmas period, the factories would actually shut down. And they would only keep a very, very skeleton staff on, perhaps a couple of engineers or a foreman or something like that. And they would be busy designing the sets for the next year, because over the summer months, the sale of radios dropped off considerably. Over the Christmas months, you weren't employed. You were out of work. And I used to go to a restaurant out at Bondi. A chap I knew had a restaurant out at Bondi, and over the Christmas period, to get a few bob for Christmas, I used to go out there, and my job was to go down to the markets and get the fowls, and then come back again and pluck them and clean them for the restaurant. That was interesting work, I suppose, in one respect, that I was grateful for it, because if it hadn't been for that, I'd have been broke over the Christmas period. And then round about end of February towards March, the factories would get back into production, so you'd start looking around to get back into the factory again. If you're lucky enough, you got back in again, and away you went for for another perhaps another 6 months in the factory till they closed down again over the Christmas period.
It was very seasonal. Yeah, indeed. Yeah, it was so that you dreaded the passing of your wonderful Christmas holiday break, and tailing off into February, and what we call the Ides of March. The Ides of March. Oh dear. And if you were able to get through the Ides of March without being sacked, you counted your blessings, because that was really the low period of the year. And there was always the release of new models and or some other such activity going on, which would tend to boost the business. But, midwinter was a most active time, simply because people were buying their radios to listen to around the fireplace, you know, and stay home. That's simple as that, the domestic scene.
Radio had become so popular that parts and whole receivers simply disappeared from the factories.
There was a lot of parts used to get stolen from the factories. There's no two ways about that. When I worked at STC, the amount of stuff that went out of STC was unreal. And there was a chap working there with us. And I said to a mate of mine, I think the mate of mine said to me, he said, "Do you know this chap at all?" I said, "No, I don't." But I said, if my judgment is correct, I said, "I think he's a detective." I said, you'll find he'll be working here amongst us boys, and I said, he'll be talking to us. I said, and the next thing I said, you'll find he'll disappear. And this is precisely what happened. He worked in the factory with us for about a fortnight, maybe a little bit longer, I don't quite know. But we all said, "Where's Jack or Harry?" I just forget what his name was, but he'd gone. He wasn't there anymore. His job was, he was from the police department, and he was there to find out what was going on, And the next thing, there was quite a few chaps got raided their homes and found all bits and pieces and everything else in them, of course, the funny part about a lot of the chaps that worked in the radio trades in the early days, of course, you didn't get much money, so there was a lot of thieving went on with stuff in radio factories, and with STC, of course, as I said, a lot of them were caught taking bits and pieces. But the stupid part about it was that they were actually stealing bits and pieces that were of no use for them. They had no idea what they were.
There wasn't a great deal of that went on. There were cases, I can remember, cases of people. For example, in one place I worked, there were two brothers, one on the day shift and one on the night shift, and the man on the day shift used to come round at night, and he'd be handed a few components or receivers over the fence by his brother or colleague, if that was the case. But no, there wasn't a lot of it went on.
I've heard of cases where, in some factories, where they actually had, they almost had body searches.
Oh, well, yes, this used to happen at Tasma. Periodically, they'd put a search on, and you'd have to empty all the stuff out of your pockets and everything else before you went out the door, see whether you had anything in your pockets. But of course, if you got the wind of the fact that there was going to be a search on, of course there was nothing taken, and if you wanted to take anything, you went out the lavatory and poked it through the window of the lavatory down the lane at the back of the lavatory, and you collected it that way. But I wasn't in for pinching stuff from factories, because it wasn't my nature and it wasn't my idea to pinch stuff, because I've seen that many of them getting caught, and I reckoned, I said to myself, it's just not worth it, you know. I was never into it because of that reason.
The normal progression for promising young radio engineers might take them from assembly and wiring through to being an inspector, and then possibly a move up to testing. After this, it was to the laboratory, designing new sets, or over to the service area looking after the difficult cases. Elizabeth Wallace was hired as a tester because of her technical skills, but in the early 30s, the radio factory was very much a male preserve.
They had names for everybody. Everybody had a nickname, and my nickname was Dillinger. Where they got Dillinger from, I don't know, but they called me Dillinger at any rate, and there was Long Tom, and there was... All of them had nicknames, different names, and Long Tom, there's a big tall chap that worked alongside of me, he said, Dylan, Jerry, he said, you're wanted over in the cloakroom. I said, who wants me? What do they want? He said, oh, I don't know, you have to go and find out, I suppose. So I went over the cloakroom to find out who wanted me, and only to find out there was about a dozen blokes here, and they grabbed me and pulled all my clothes off, and all my private parts they smeared with solvent flux and threw me trousers down in the lane at the back of the factory. So I had to run out with nothing and no trousers on and retrieve me trousers and then make a hurried retreat into the washroom to clean myself up and get back to work again. That was my once that was over, I was right. I was initiated into the factory and I was one of the mobs of the thing.
Women were employed in radio factories on mechanical assembly work, coil and transformer winding, and then soldering sets on the assembly line. According to the male engineers I spoke to, the theory was that women were more patient and accurate with repetitious tasks.
What used to be done in those days was for mass production, so-called, was that the girls wiring sets up would have in front of them what they called charts, which were cardboard, strawboard. Panels about 2 feet by 18 inches, and on these were drawn illustrations of the particular component parts that they had to fit into the chassis, the panel strip and the wires and the coloured wires and the capacitors and ta-ra-ta-ra. Well, apparently I showed enough artistic flair to be put to the task of drawing these things up, all in colour. Things were pretty basic, you know. But for one chassis, you had a pile of panels that was about 4 feet high, you know. It was quite a stack of these things, because each individual step had to be so illustrated.
I was taken on there immediately and trained for aligning radio receivers, which was... semi-technical work, and I was apparently the first woman they'd ever been able to train for that work. There were other girls on the factory line assembling, but they said they'd never been able to train any other woman to align a radio receiver, and so I used to enjoy that work very much.
Because of the work they did testing the receivers so that the stations were on the right spot on the dial, the testers worked in a special part of the factory.
We used to work in a shielded cage, a wire cage, which shielded the operating bench and the operator from outside interference, from electrical interference. There were three of us. There were three cages, and... there were three of us working full-time on aligning the radio sets. As far as I remember, it might have taken perhaps half an hour to align each receiver, because the alignment was always a bit of a compromise, trying to get reasonably even results over the whole span of the broadcast band, the whole spectrum.
So the other two aligners were men?
Yes.
Elizabeth Wallace finally left National Radio in Adelaide after working there for a couple of years and went on to become a maths and science teacher.
Testers, we were called. The people who were aligning radios were aligning and testing, and I think the male testers were getting about £5 a week And yes, I was beginning to feel a bit disgruntled because I was only getting about two. Yes, it, yes, it was. Looking back on it, probably was slave labour, but I didn't see it as that way, and it was just that it was lowly paid. But the conditions were quite comfortable. There wasn't the pressure of work that there is in modern times. We just worked on at, you know, at a reasonable rate, and that was it. And the atmosphere was quite friendly. The men were quite friendly, and I didn't notice any discrimination, although I think sometimes they must have felt that I'd perhaps be a threat to them if, you know, if more females had come into the industry, that it could have been a threat to their £5-a-week jobs if they could get people like me for £2 a week. But they never showed it to me. They never showed me any animosity at all.
While women were much cheaper to employ in the radio factories, a number of former engineers reported a strange experience.
Yeah, some of the sets began to play up and not make their specified figures, not by a long shot, until it was discovered that certain females at certain times of the month, if they were handling the Bakelite base plate of these things, the perspiration on their hands disturbed the performance. One had to be terribly diplomatic about how you went about, you know, finding out who and what was happening, and ta-ra, ta-ra, you know. Anyway, I had the services of the female supervisor to track that one, help me track that one through. And indeed, certain people had to be taken on to other duties at certain times, because what would happen was that the leakage across the terminals was so high from body salts that it threw the whole thing quite out of whack, you know. The AGC voltage would all go silly and the BIOS would go wonky and so on.
You were able to trace it, yeah, track it back.
Yeah, right. And there was virtually nothing I could do about it. I didn't find any treatment that would counteract that. You know, we tried washing the Bakelite in thinners and all the usual things you'd have around that you could safely apply to it, and we just scrapped them. Yeah. So, the same thing applies, of course, in coil winding, that they mustn't touch the wires or anything, otherwise you get green spots and things like that developing inside coils.
In Soldering On, you heard Neville Williams, Jack Ross, Arthur Spring, Elizabeth Wallace, George Mann and Keith Sherlock. In the next program, Calling All Cars, we'll hear about early police wireless, as well as other two-way radio operations like the Flying Doctor. Music for the series was written and performed by Kathy Peters. Production of Bright Sparks, Sharon Davis, Peter McLeod and Stephen Rapley for the ABC's Social History Unit.
I can distinctly remember Sir Ernest walking around through the factory and talking to people. He always had, a number of followers, and they would be the management and some of the foremen in the factory. But I can quite distinctly remember the figure of Sir Ernest in the place, and he used to give us a Christmas present every year. The men would be given, 100 cigarettes, and the girls in the factory would be given a box of chocolates. And that was from Sir Ernest Fisk, in appreciation of the work that we'd been doing through the years.